wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO here in Portland, where the time is 9 o'clock, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Clayton Morgeridge, along with our engineer, Patsy Kullberg, bringing you an hour of news, views, reviews, and interviews from the mole's underground perspective. The Old Mole was Karl Marx's image of the revolution that works away underground to root down the edifices of capitalism and the corrupt political system that governs us all on behalf of capital. That mass of accumulated socially created wealth that is so far controlled by a very small elite class of wealthy people. But the mole digs away until one day the revolution, unforeseen by the masters, erupts and sweeps away the ruling structures of capital and the capitalist state, and together the people can create a social order designed to benefit all human and other life on this planet. On today's show, we'll be talking about war, in particular the Vietnam War, and the Ken Burns effect on our memory of it. We'll also hear about organizing for reproductive justice here in Oregon, and questions about global wealth and poverty, and a review of a new novel by Jennifer Egan about World War II, New York gangsters, and the role women played on the dock in wartime. We'll also hear a poem by Marge Piercy that ties together some of these themes. If you want to hear all or any part of this show again or recommend it to your friends, it will be available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show will be up in a few days. Well, let's get started then with the Old Mole's Lori Mercier, who is here to talk with Christian Appy about the Ken Burns series on Vietnam airing on PBS and what the series missed. Lori.
Thanks, Clayton. Yes, with me on the phone is Christian Appy, professor of history at the University of Massachusetts and author of numerous publications about the Cold War and the American War in Vietnam, including his recent book, American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity. He also writes for The Nation and Process and a number of other publications, but check out his blog on processhistory.org, where he has spoken about the recent Ken Burns, Lynn Novick televised series on Vietnam. Welcome to KBOO, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
Let's talk about the Burns-Novick series that recently aired on PBS and what will likely become the most watched and probably popular official story of the war. And let's talk about what this series missed, starting with the actual history of the American War in Vietnam. What was it really about?
Well, unfortunately, but predictably, the documentary takes a kind of middle-of-the-road position that the war was really a tragedy on all sides, that it was begun by men in good faith, out of fateful misunderstandings, and there was, therefore, it does not ever really give voice to the possibility that, in fact, it was begun actually in bad faith, out of an intentional desire, not fateful misunderstandings, but out of an intentional desire to preserve and expand American global power in the aftermath of World War II. So these more critical perspective is one of the most glaring absences in the film. And there are others. For me, perhaps the most disturbing is its inability or unwillingness to really connect the most relevant aspects of that history to more recent times. In this entire 18-hour marathon, for example, unless I missed it, I don't think the word Iraq in Afghanistan is mentioned even once. So the connections we might have made to the earlier war in Vietnam and the really glaring and troubling parallels between our ongoing imperial adventures around the world is really missing. In its place, I think the accent is more on a kind of therapeutic approach to history, where clearly, and Burns and Novick have said this at countless promotional events, their effort is to provide what they describe as a vaccine to cure what they see as the national divisions and polarizations that were born in World War II without really engaging the question of what would it take to heal those divisions, and if so, what kind of forgetfulness and omissions and avoidance of difficult questions does that involve? So those are some of my thoughts.
Yeah, and that healing or therapeutic aim, of course, distances the war from intention or also just the context. The series, it seems to me, is often referring to the war as a civil war, and aside from the first episode, I think, that deals with the French colonial context, there's not anything about the Vietnamese perspective. It's, as you point out, an American centrism of the series that always has U.S. veterans and their families getting the first and last word. So what about those Vietnamese voices that are interspersed in the series but really not heard or not part of the main narrative?
Well, it is good to hear them when they're there, and I understand that at first Ken Burns was reluctant to include any, and that Lynn Novick talked him into having them there. But yes, they are framed in a way that, as you say, it's quite true. The Americans are given the first and last word in every episode, and the anti-colonial perspective, which is so crucial to understanding the origins and the outcome of the war, is missing. It's as if it's sort of an old-fashioned idea that this is and misleading, and false, absolutely false idea that this was a civil war between North and South. It was a nationwide struggle for national reunification and independence, and the communist-led side would not have been successful had it not been able to stir up long historic passions for that quest, passions that involved millions of people around the world at that time. So we have kind of a Cold War framework in the Burns documentary rather than the framework that the Vietnamese would have used in its place, which is fundamentally an anti-imperial or anti-colonial perspective.
Also, in terms of the lack of Vietnamese perspective, the continual emphasis on failure and tragedy from the American perspective gives little attention to the numbers of dead on the Asian side, that probably 4 million Southeast Asians were killed especially from the massive bombing.
Right. It's mentioned as a kind of afterthought in the final episode and without any effort to really separate out the majority of deaths, which were civilian, and even more importantly, to emphasize that it was the United States and its South Vietnamese allies who were doing the vast majority of killing of civilians. There is throughout the documentary a very disturbing effort to create these very false equivalencies. Every time there is evidence of American wrongdoing, they'll be quick to offer an example of wrongdoing by the other side in ways that completely overshadow the fact that had the United States not intervened first to support the French reconquest of Vietnam after World War II, and then in the 1950s to try to create a permanent South Vietnam in defiance, actually, of the terms of the Geneva Accords, which had called for nationwide elections in 1956, had we not intervened in what I would call the waging of aggressive war, the war would never have happened. And, I mean, we can't know what history would have unfolded in its place, but it's certainly highly unlikely that it would have resulted in these 4 million deaths that you speak of.
Certainly the term genocide is never used in the series, even though, especially in the last years of the Nixon-Kissinger's gratuitous massive bombing, it seems to me that that's what we could call this.
Yeah, you could have interesting debates about whether it rises to genocidal status or not, but the fact that that debate is missing is typical. I mean, I will say this, as you would expect from a highly funded venture like this, done over many years with all their resources and talents, they were able to produce a huge amount of really interesting archival footage, and there is in that footage a lot of evidence of suffering and death, but at almost every turn, the most damning of the evidence is kind of softened or marginalized, and no voices really take it to that next logical step. I mean, they're sort of constantly pulling their punches so that American leaders will deceive the public, but they don't lie to the public. Or we experience failure in Vietnam, but not defeat. Or even in the My Lai massacre, in which American troops killed some 500 unarmed and unresisting civilians, those are described as killings rather than as murders. Or this one example that really plagues me. They did introduce us to an American colonel named Emerson, who said to his men, the men in his battalion, "I will offer a case of whiskey to the first one of you who can bring me the severed head of a Viet Cong." And somebody, in fact, did that, and you see an image of a severed head in the film, so it's horrifying. But instead of having the narrator conclude that here we have an American colonel that is clearly bribing his men to commit a war crime, the same colonel is described as courageous and relentless. I mean,
it's very disturbing. Yeah. That kind of glossing over or the use of terminology that's very soothing rather than critical. Another problematic feature and voices missing from the series are anti-war activists. Mm-hmm. There are good segments with Vietnam veterans against the war.
Yes.
But it's as if they are removed from the larger anti-war movement, who are really caricatured.
Yeah, that is one of the more disturbing, maybe the most disturbing, is that the most diverse and vibrant anti-war movement in our history, I would argue, is so marginal. They really only interview a single person who was part of what might be called the civilian anti-war movement. As you say, the anti-war Vietnam veterans are allowed to speak, and it's if in this film the only people that have the credibility to make criticisms of the war have to have that military credential. But Bill Zimmerman, the one anti-war activist who speaks, who knows what was edited out, but he never makes a really impassioned argument against the war. He actually has more negative things to say about the anti-war movement itself, and even reinforces this really false notion that the movement was motivated by self-interest after a certain point rather than moral conviction. So, and, of course, this old notion that the anti-war movement mistreated Vietnam veterans routinely and commonly. And, in fact, one of the things that I believe is that there were these overlapping intersections between the anti-war movement that have not really been paid attention to. So, yeah, I mean, that's disturbing. And think of the legacy of that in terms of where we are now. I mean, again, going back to the point about not engaging any debates about the persistence of American imperial policies around the world, does this film serve to awaken critical-minded thoughts about why we still have more than 800 bases on foreign soil and are engaged in military operations, according to journalist Nick Terse, in more than 130 countries every year? That sort of stuff just doesn't appear.
It's as if it's frozen in time, this unique event that's not connected to the continued exercise of American imperial power.
Yeah, it is weird. Obviously, it's a subject you can't completely whitewash because there's so many disturbing elements about it. And yet it does seem frozen. Somehow I think the music works that way, too. It kind of freezes it in the past. And I would say that a lot of the Burns approach to filmmaking does privilege commemoration over critical thinking, and it has a kind of elegiac feel to it. It sort of safely preserves the past in the past.
And this connects to just the recent commemoration of Veterans Day and the centrality of American veterans in the whole Burns series. But as you point out in another piece, this kind of commemoration that just basically the mantra, "thank you for your service," ignores how veterans have actually been treated or the continued involvement in forcing the American military into these adventures around the world multiple times every year.
It's such an empty gesture and doesn't really require anything of us. I often tell students it would be better to meet veterans and say, "Will you please tell me about your service," rather than just thanking them and walking away. I think it allows us to go on with this perpetual war-making machine that requires less than 1% of Americans to do the fighting.
Certainly that kind of linkage to Vietnam is important to emphasize in terms of the United States again declaring war under false pretenses.
Yeah, undeclared wars and, you know, these impossible counterinsurgency missions where the goal is to prop up these governments and places like in Saigon that have no possibility of gaining the broad support of their own people, and where American troops are regarded as hostile invaders at best, and that somehow they're also supposed to win the hearts and minds of these people, and these connections aren't made. I would have loved to have seen some scenes where some of the Vietnam veterans are in a room talking to some younger vets from Iraq and Afghanistan, and kind of comparing note and making those connections. But
right.
Each interview is done in isolation, as if even people, you know, you'll see this occasionally, they'll say very completely contradictory things, but there's no effort to try to sort of sharpen those distinctions. It's as if all these, you know, Burns says this a lot, that it's possible to have multiple truths about war that coexist peacefully, and it kind of just, again, inhibits critical thinking about the past and the present.
Well, thank you so much, Christian Appy, for joining us today on the Old Mole Show. And I encourage listeners to check out the work of Christian Appy, APPY. Thank you.
Thanks, Lori. Nice to be here.
Up, two, three, four, marching down the street. The rolling of the drums and the tramping of the feet. General salutes and the mothers waving we. Here comes the big parade. Don't be afraid, price is paid, one more parade. So young, so strong, so ready for the war. So willing to go and die upon a foreign shore. All march together, everybody looks the same. So there is no one you can blame. Don't be ashamed, light the flame, one more parade.
And that's Phil Oakes singing One More Parade, following up on the conversation between Lori Mercier and Christian Appy about the Ken Burns series Vietnam. Here on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, I'm Clayton Morgridge. We're going to hear an interview about the fight for reproductive justice here in Oregon in just a moment, but first, here's a poem that speaks both to women's rights to control their own lives and bodies and to the fact that ever since the Vietnam War, the U.S. continues to wreak havoc with the dogs of war in many parts of the world. This is Marge Piercy's poem, I Am Wrestling with Despair, read for us here by the Old Mole's Fran Michel.
Every day is worse than the one before, a killing of all that was legislated to be kind, helpful, healthy for all living creatures, prisoners of this earth. The meanness of it gets me, the hatred of who have less money and things and thus count less and should be punished or simply pushed into some locked closet of poverty and forgotten, except for occasional rhetoric blaming them for the state of that closet. How do these men stand being so cold and full of malice? They have plenty left to flog women for having bodies. How dare women desire? How dare we choose, say no, resist, insist? I can't give up, no matter how cozy that looks by contrast with all this jabbering, this attempt to organize our anger into some kind of weapon. That's I Am Wrestling with Despair by Marge Piercy from the November 2017 issue of Monthly Review.
Thank you, Fran. The New York Times reports that President Trump, or more likely Vice President Mike Pence, has filled top positions at the Department of Health and Human Services with individuals who have devoted their adult lifetimes to the anti-abortion cause. Well, here in Oregon, the Portland Democratic Socialists of America has organized a panel on reproductive justice to be held on November 17th. With details about that, here is the Old Mole's Jan Hocken to talk with Dr. Xenia Junkier, who will be on the panel. Jan.
Xenia Junkier, welcome to KBOO this morning.
Thanks for having me, Jan. I appreciate it.
Well, we'll be talking later, giving people details on the panel this Friday, and you'll be speaking along with other reproductive justice activists here in Portland. But let's start with the most recent organizing campaign that resulted in House Bill 3391. Oregon has arisen as a sort of beacon on the hill nationally in terms of the very depressing terrain so many reproductive rights activists face in other places in the country. And this was quite a progressive bit of legislation, and it came out of a very broad vision of reproductive justice, guiding that, the organizing behind it. So let's talk a bit first about that bill, what's important about it, and then what's involved in fulfilling and continuing to work to fulfill its promise.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think you're right when you call it the most progressive piece of legislation in the country. I think that, you know, that's language that's been used in the media, and it's also language that we used internally when we were advocating for the expansion of services and the addition of services in this bill. I think the top few things that are really important about this bill are, number one, the codification of the right to abortion in Oregon law. The second would be that there's a non-discrimination clause, which means gender non-conforming folks don't have to prove that they deserve services based on their gender marker, et cetera, or get denied services based on their gender marker. And the other component that was a really exciting component was the expansion of services for folks who are categorically excluded from Medicaid, including undocumented women. So being able to have access to postpartum care is really important and something that we really pushed for, and I think was something that was a real challenge because it was easy for those pieces, as it often is for a lot of our communities of color, to become invisible in pieces of legislation. But through the work of the Pro-Choice Coalition and really strong advocates as part of that coalition, we were able to keep those particular components. So I think we're really happy with the bill. You know, we know that there's a lot of work to do, but we see this as a success and are working on the implementation now.
You mentioned the pro-choice forces, and there's been quite a sea change in thinking about abortion within a broader reproductive justice framework versus some of the early organizing here in Portland around reproductive rights, which was in the 80s, a broader vision that went beyond access to abortion. How do you think about the concept of reproductive justice and how it goes beyond pro-choice politics?
Yeah, I think I really hold by the definition and the framework of reproductive justice that came out of the work of Sister Song and a lot of folks who were saying, you know what, you're talking about choice, you're talking about access, you're talking about families, but you're not really considering all of the other indications of how we understand people to have autonomy and the ability to make choices that impact their families, regardless of what others believe and how others believe those choices should be made. And so I think that one of the exciting things about using a reproductive justice lens, especially at the work of NARAL, is that we can push not only ourselves internally, but our constituents to see choice as much more than just one's access to and right to choose, but really taking into account factors like economic justice, racial justice, gender justice, understanding how the social determinants of health will actually figure into what kind of access people can actually have. You know, we talk about access a lot. We talk about meaningful access a lot. We talk about choice, but I still think that we are at a place where we're not necessarily talking about race and gender and sexuality and economic justice and immigrant justice. And I think we need to be at a place where we're having all of those conversations when we talk about choice and when we talk about, you know, family planning or whatever kind of language that we want to use around how and when people decide to become parents or expand their family or...
There are different constraints on choice in different contexts that you can have. On one level, an argument has been made throughout the history of feminism that wealthy women have always had more choices, including the choice of access to an abortion when it's not legal. Mm-hmm. And even in the post-Roe v. Wade era, choices are powerfully constrained depending on your economic situation, and race and class intersect around those constraints in powerful ways. So the vision also is supporting women in carrying children into the world, as well as ending pregnancies that are unhealthy or that they choose not to carry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for me, coming from a space where I was working a lot with children and families, and my background has a lot of, you know, education and, you know, work with children and families, I came to this work believing that, yes, we need to support a person's choice to choose, and we really need to support when their choice is, yes, I want to bring a child into this world. And what does that mean? What kinds of services need to be available? What kind of healthcare needs to be available? How do you have access to culturally relevant and appropriate services, stable housing, et cetera, so that children and families can thrive? And so for me, those are the really exciting parts about expanding this idea of choice, is that we're talking about the full spectrum, not just that act of choosing to become a parent.
And transformation on a very broad level, both the healthcare system, what it means to have a healthcare system, and broader notions of health.
Yeah, absolutely.
Healthy communities.
Yeah, we had a lot of those conversations when we talked about expanding services for folks who are categorically excluded. And I think it was really important to us that people were able to access services when they needed them, and that when you delivered, your services don't get cut off and then you are no longer somebody who gets to access these services. It's not fair, it's not just, and it certainly isn't how we want our community to be treated here.
Now, there's kind of a loophole for Catholic healthcare institutions like Providence that governs about a third of the hospital beds in Oregon, and access to hospital care is very important for women in many pregnancies. And as long as there's a heartbeat, they will not end a pregnancy. In Catholic hospitals, there's also access to contraception, abortion services through Providence Healthcare plans. Mm-hmm. What about that aspect of this law that and bringing them into compliance?
Yeah, you know, it's something that I can't speak specifically to. This is an area that's newer for me. I mean, I recognize the regulations and the stipulations around services that they can provide, but I didn't know the depth and the breadth of it. I really was able to learn from my colleagues just how intricate those pathways are to making sure that folks have access to these services. So I think as a coalition, one thing we're doing is just making sure that moving towards the implementation of REA, and that we are holding folks accountable to the language that is in our bill that states that folks have the right to access this particular service.
So there's quite a bit of organizing and confrontation on that front.
Yeah, yeah. I think that we're nowhere near done. And
but, you know, these big religions are big religions for a reason. They often can be quite flexible and resourceful when mm-hmm. they have to. And Providence, for example, has negotiated other arrangements to stay in business. So mm-hmm. we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we will. And we definitely need strong advocate voices to make sure that these things, again, the integrity of this bill makes it through implementation.
Fulfilled. Mm-hmm. So in closing, let's talk a little bit about this Democratic Socialists of America Feminist Branch panel on Friday, which sounds like it'll be a lot of fun. It'll
yeah.
be from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Lucky Lab North Tap Room in Portland, 1700 North Killingsworth Street, and that is the Lucky Lab North Tap Room on the east side of the river. There's a Lucky Lab Labrador pub on the west side, but we'll be on the east side. Can you just say a bit about the panel and what's going to happen Friday night?
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite things about being on this panel a handful of months ago was that it really was centering the voices of women of color, LGBTQ folks, and I think that that's powerful. I think there's ways we can say that we do that and that we don't do that, but I do think that anyone coming out will see, you know, the meaningful and the intentional nature of how this panel was put together and hear from some really amazing folks.
Okay, and there'll be drinks and pizza or whatever there, too, that people can purchase, so it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully folks will come on out. I'm looking forward to it.
Yes. And they can go on the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, Portland Facebook page or website to get more details. Thanks so much, Xenia Junker, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Jan. I appreciate it.
Welcome! You're not welcome anymore. Weren't you the one who tried to hurt me with goodbye? You think I crumbled? You think I'd lay down and die? Oh, no, not I. I will survive. Oh, as long as I know how to love, I know I'll still alive. I've got all my life to live. I've got all my love to give. And I'll survive. I will survive.
And that's Gloria Gaynor with I Will Survive, following up on Jan Hawkins' conversation with Xenia Junker about the upcoming Democratic Socialists of America panel on reproductive justice. And you heard this on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Well, coming up soon on the show, our book mole, Larry Bolden, will be here to talk about Jennifer Egan's new novel that takes place on the Brooklyn docks during World War II. But right now, here is the Old Mole's Bill Resnick to talk with Mark Weisbrot about whether China's economic growth has raised global living standards. Bill.
Hi, thanks, Clayton. Mark Weisbrot, welcome to KABU.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Mark Weisbrot is a co-founder, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. Near every week, you see his op-eds and articles in the left and also the establishment press. His books include Failed, What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy, and with Dean Baker, Social Security, the Phony Crisis. Recently, he and others at the Center for Economic Policy and Research, they released a study, The Scorecard on Development, 1960 to 2016, China and the Global Economic Rebound. It agrees that economic growth in the developing world did rebound, and in fact, substantially grew in the period 2000 through 2016. But as to the reasons for the recent growth spurt, the study challenges the standard explanation that it was the result of U.S.-led neoliberal globalization, that in fact, they conclude, it was almost entirely from China and its very different model of development strategies. Mark, before we get to your study, I have a couple of caveats. One, that expanding economic growth as it is measured does not mean that all ships rise, that life gets better for most people, like in this country, in fact. But we'll get to that later. First, Mark Weisbrot, tell us about your challenge to the conventional wisdom about development and growth.
Well, you could start with like President Obama's last speech at the UN, where he said, over the last 25 years, the number of people living in extreme poverty has been cut from nearly 40% of humanity to under 10%. Now, these are World Bank numbers, and there's a lot of dispute over them, but nonetheless, just taking those at face value, Obama has tried to say, well, this is the success of the globalization, and the particular form of globalization that Washington promoted over these past 25 years, which includes indiscriminate opening up to trade, international trade and capital flows, deregulation, including financial deregulation, abandoning the industrial and development policies that countries, that almost every developing country used to have back in the 1970s, and making central banks independent, the whole what we usually call neoliberal policies. But then when you look at this poverty reduction that he refers to, actually two-thirds of it was in China, and the net poverty reduction, that is. And if you go back further from 1981 to 2010, China accounted for 94% of the net poverty reduction in terms of people, you know, living below the extreme poverty line. So, again, just taking Obama's statement at face value, looking at the past 25 years, two-thirds of the poverty reduction he's talking about is China. And then the other third, China had a lot to do with that as well, because during that period, especially from 1990 to the peak in 2013, the low and middle income countries, developing countries, sent an increasing amount of exports to China as it grew rapidly to become the largest economy in the world. So their exports to China increased from just a minuscule 0.1% to 2.6% of their GDP during this period.
Hundreds of billions of dollars of increase as a result of trade with China.
That's right. So what Obama and other people are really celebrating is Chinese globalization. That's what's done very well. They multiplied their income per person 21 times since 1980. But their globalization was very, very different from the globalization that President Obama was praising. You know, most of their investment during this period was controlled by the government. They have a huge role still for state-owned enterprises. As recently as 2010, those were 44% of the major industrial companies were state-owned. Foreign investment was very carefully controlled so that it fit in with their overall development plan. They had strict currency controls. They didn't have an independent central bank. That was also controlled by the central government. Their financial system is still state-controlled mostly. And they also, when they got foreign investment, which they did get a lot of, they had what we call performance requirements. They required these foreign companies to transfer technology and to promote exports and to hire local managers and engineers. And so they got something out of the foreign investment. So this is a whole completely different model of development than what, and I don't want to single out Obama, it's, you know, all the media, most of the media and most politicians and even some economists, although economists won't say, you know, if you look for economists, they won't quite make statements like this because they do know the facts, but they haven't been very enthusiastic about stating the actual facts of this neoliberal globalization versus the Chinese globalization that has brought most of the economic progress in the world over the last 25 years.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Mark Weisbrot, co-founder, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research, who released a recent report done with others at the center, The Scorecard on Development 1960-2016, China and the Economic Rebound. Why don't you conclude talking about sort of what those development policies that many third world developing countries used in the 60s and 70s when there was considerable growth. It was the 80s when neoliberalism got the 80s to year 2000 that growth enormously slowed. What are those elements of a development policy as you see it?
Well, there are a lot of what China did on a, you know, China's model isn't exactly applicable, I mean, or completely, because they were transitioning from a more or less completely planned economy to a more mixed economy. But nonetheless, yeah, if you look at the successful years when you did have rapid growth in the vast majority of the developing world in the 60s and 70s, and by the way, I left that out, I'm glad you mentioned it, as the other part of the paper was showing, it was comparing the 21st century to that terrible long-term failure of the neoliberal era from 1980 to 2000 when you had this big slowdown in economic growth and also, a not surprisingly, a slowdown in progress on the social indicators and health indicators, especially like infant and child mortality and adult mortality and education and so on. And that's also documented in our paper. So what did these countries do? Well, they did have planning. They had industrial policies. They had development planning where the government played an active role in trying to move the economy from lower value-added areas of production like agriculture and services to industry and to areas where you had much more rapid productivity growth so that the country could become a developed country. And they also did control their central banks. So the central bank, you know, wouldn't wreck everything else, like, say, the European Central Bank has done in Europe until 2015, after the crisis until 2015. They were playing a very negative role in trying to enforce austerity and things like that that really made things worse. And so these countries had better fiscal and monetary policies, but they didn't do the kind of thing that you're not supposed to do, which is to cut spending during a recession like you saw in Latin America in the 1980s, where they just had a whole lost decade, and then mostly into the 90s, had a whole 20 years with very little growth at all in per capita income. So a lot of that was their fiscal and monetary policies were what we call pro-cyclical. That is, they took an economy that was already in recession or was shrinking or slowing and made it worse for years, like you've seen and we've talked about in Greece, for example. So you didn't have those kinds of policies very much at all in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. This really came in with the neoliberal period. And then you had other forms of regulation, of capital flows, of trade.
They had protection of their own industries.
They had definitely a lot of protection.
As China does. This is Mark Weisbrot, Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Mark Weisbrot. It seems to me that the model, though, that China has pursued, and in fact the whole idea of growth and what kind of growth we need, it seems to me we're moving into a world where those kinds of figures, even though they're important, they miss the what happens to the bottom 50% of people in these populations. Growth does not trickle down. In fact, a lot of growth leads to the destruction of sort of traditional agriculture, traditional communities, people flowing into big cities, these anonymous, huge places on the outskirts of it, and living there is no picnic, and you can't even grow your own food. It seems to me there's tremendous misery is being created by that growth. And then finally, it's unsustainable. China is the greenhouse gas emitter of the on the top of the world and will remain that way for a long time, even if their promises aren't met for getting rid of coal and having a new energy system. In any event, tell us about that. It seems to me we really have to rethink everything about growth now.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, first of all, I think that growth does, over a longer period of time, growth generally does trickle down. You know, it's a very unusual period that we've had in the U.S. in the past 35 years where you have, well, growth has slowed, but the growth that we had, mostly the income gains meant mostly to the upper 1% or 10% of the income distribution. That, you know, if you look at the whole economic history of the United States, that's a very rare event. I mean, the 30 years prior, you know, the first half of the post-World War II period wasn't like that at all. You had rising living standards. That is much more the norm. If you look at 20 or 30-year period of capitalism, it actually does trickle down quite a bit. In China, it obviously did. I mean, 800 million people were pulled across the poverty line. Now, at the same time, inequality increased enormously in China. It went from one of the most equal developing countries in terms of distribution of income to one of the most unequal. But they grew so fast that they still pulled all these people out of poverty. But they wouldn't have had to grow quite that fast if they just hadn't increased inequality so much. But no, growth is really essential to economic growth. You know, it isn't this terrible thing that most people or a lot of people on the left say it is. If you look at what growth actually is as a matter of accounting, there's two things that contribute to economic growth in any economy. One is population growth. Now that, or labor force growth, but we're just holding labor force participation constant, so we would say population growth. Now that is destructive to the environment, and it's not a positive thing. But the other part of economic growth is productivity growth. So you're producing more with less labor. And of course, there are environmental costs to that, but they don't have to be. For example, we could actually greatly increase our growth here in the United States by transforming our infrastructure into a green infrastructure. So we would be actually lowering greenhouse gas emissions at the same time that we increase economic growth. That's just one example.
But there are so many. Mark, I think we have to conclude. It does seem to me, though, that when, in fact, trickle-down did work for a very long time, you had first growth everywhere and labor was needed and labor was in short supply. Or second, you had these governments that were controlled by labor parties. And neither are true right now. And I'm afraid
saying that growth automatically trickles down. Obviously, it doesn't. But
right.
My point is that if you look at long periods of history, and I don't like to use the word trickle down because that's a right-wing kind of, I wouldn't say it like that. I would just say that in general, when the economy grows, most or even all, the vast majority of people will gain from that. How much they gain depends on, of course, the balance of forces in the political sphere.
Right. Mark, thanks a lot. It was really good talking to you. Growth is surely necessary for the bottom half of the world population and of productivity, but it's not just stimulating growth. It requires a politics, as you pointed out, and it requires the interventions that lead to that instead of just greater inequality and isolation for those poor people. Mark, you're terrific. Thanks a lot for talking to us. Thanks for your studies, and thanks to the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
Thank you for having a great show.
Right. Thanks.
That's Devochka with Commerce City Sister. And before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with Mark Weisbrot about China and global poverty. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. We're going to close out the show now with a review of Manhattan Beach, the new novel by Jennifer Egan. And here's our book mole, Larry Bolden.
Good morning. I want to talk to you this morning about a startlingly good book by the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jennifer Egan. The Pulitzer-winning book, A Visit from the Goon Squad, was a daringly different, even shocking book. But what's surprising about her newest novel, Manhattan Beach, is that it is a straightforward historical novel. As one commentator says, after stretching the boundaries of fiction in myriad ways, Egan does perhaps the only thing left that could surprise. She writes a thoroughly traditional novel, realistically detailed, poetically charged, and utterly satisfying. Apparently, there's nothing Egan can't do. Close quote. The novel begins as Anna, who is 11, accompanies her father, Eddie, to the home of a rich man, Mr. Stiles. Turns out that Eddie takes his young daughter with him on his rather mysterious business calls. As we come to learn as the novel progresses, Dexter Stiles is a gangster, and Eddie Kerrigan works as a messenger for a powerful longshoreman union boss. Anna is a clever girl who could, quote, feel the logic of mechanical parts in her fingertips. This came so natural that she could only think that other people didn't really try. They always looked, which was as useless when assembling things as studying a picture by touching it, close quote. Anna finds herself torn between the life of her mother, sister Lydia, and her aunt Brianne, and the bigger world life of her father. Lydia has a severely crippling disease which renders her unable to care for herself or even to walk and talk, and her mother devotes most of her life to caring for this strangely beautiful but crippled daughter. When Eddie hears the festive gaiety of his wife, sister-in-law, and daughters, and notices how things abruptly change at his entrance, he finds himself wondering if the girls and women were easier and happier without him. Soon enough, and for reasons that emerge slowly in the novel, Eddie is suddenly gone from the scene, and his family has to fend for themselves. This is all occurring in the 30s, and as World War II increasingly consumes the world, Anna seeks employment in the naval shipyards. Eventually, she becomes intrigued by the divers who work on the damaged ships, and given the shortage of men, women are hired in many traditionally male jobs in the shipyards. Although faced with the sexist behavior of both officers and enlisted men, she perseveres in her attempt to be a certified diver. Armed with a letter of recommendation from her supervisor, she's granted an interview with the officer in charge of the divers. Although he assumes from the beginning that the supervisor only recommended her in exchange for sexual favors, he accepts her into the program only because he is convinced she will fail. Quoting from the book, "Ah, your supervisor, Mr. Voss." He drew out the name as though its syllables were the last bits of meat he was sucking from a bone. Then he grinned. "I imagine he's just as eager to please you as you are to please him." Close quote. Despite being set up to fail, Anna manages to move in the diving dress that weighs several hundred pounds, and she also passes the underwater test that she is meant to fail. Egan manages to portray the sexist attitudes of the time in very clever and understated ways, and the feminism she illumines is a high point of the novel. Although Eddie Kerrigan is gone from his family, he remains an important part of the novel. After living as essentially a bagman for gangster Dexter Stiles, his disappearance seems to be at the hands of the New York mob, and much of the later parts of the novel are taken up with Anna's attempts to discover how and why he disappeared. While Anna is the primary narrator of the book's action, Eddie, who somehow escapes his fate at the hands of gangsters, resurfaces as a sailor in the Merchant Marines and subsequently survives the torpedo sinking of his ship and a harrowing lifeboat adventure. I feel I'm already revealing a bit too much of the interwoven stories. Besides telling an utterly fascinating story in this novel, Egan also displays the very substantial research she did in order to produce such a riveting account. Her portrayals of life on the docks, women workers in the naval shipyards, and even of mob activity in New Jersey and New York all ring with an authenticity due to her very considerable talents as a researcher. She says in her acknowledgments, quote, I was heartened during the years I spent circling Manhattan Beach to know that if nothing more came of the endeavor than the pleasure of having researched it, I would count myself lucky. And we readers are lucky as well that her research ended with this excellent novel. One commentator is moved to exclaim that she's maybe the very best living American novelist, and another that the book shows she is dizzyingly inventive. Inventive indeed, and also wise and insightful. She's produced a first-rate historical novel that I think will be remembered as much for its historical account as for its fast-paced, mesmerizing plot. I've been talking to you this morning about Jennifer Egan's 2017 novel, Manhattan Beach. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And that's Manhattan Beach March by John Philip Sousa, following Larry Bolden's review of Jennifer Egan's novel by the same name. And that's going to do it for today's edition of the Old Mole Variety Hour. Many thanks to Laurie Mercier and Christian Appy for their discussion of the Ken Burns documentary on Vietnam, to Xenia Junkier and Jan Hocken for their alerting us about the upcoming panel discussion on reproductive justice in Oregon, to Fran Michelle for her reading of the Marge Piercy poem, I Am Wrestling with Despair, and to Bill Resnick and Mark Weisbrot for filling us in on China and global poverty, and to Larry Bolden for his review of Manhattan Beach. Special thanks to our engineer, Patsy Kullberg. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Join us again next Monday morning for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground and radical perspective. And visit our webpage on the KBOO website, that's kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can listen to this show in a day or two, as well as past shows.